As we know, here at the Unitarian Fellowship, we search for meaning and truth, we celebrate life, and we value our place in the interdependent web of all beings. Our presentation today will be an expression of a local and famous artist's passion for a special part of the world we live in. The presentation will explore the backyard garden and the change in consciousness worldwide that is sending people into their backyards and front yards to community gardens and schoolyard gardens to reconnect with the natural process of earth-grown food in a real-world context. And so Vic Sikansky has joined us, and I'll just tell you a little bit about Vic. Probably the most famous thing about him is that he was on the same faculty I was at the university. He was born and raised in Regina. He's a graduate of the University of Saskatchewan with his B.Ed. and the University of California at Davis with his Master of Fine Arts. He also studied at Haystack Mountain School, School of Art at Deer Isle, Maine. He received an honorary doctorate award from the University of Regina. He is the recipient of many Canada Council grants and awards, including the Victoria and Albert Award for Sculpture and the Saskatchewan Order of Merit. In July 2009, Victor was named a member of the Order of Canada for his contribution to the arts as a mentor, educator, and sculptor. His bronze and ceramic sculptures have been exhibited extensively across Canada, the United States, Japan, and Europe, and his work is found in numerous museums and corporate collections, including the Mendel Art Gallery in Saskatoon, Montreal Museum of Fine Art, Museum of Fine Arts in Tokyo, and the National Gallery of Canada. Victor lives and works here in Regina. So now I'll just turn the podium over to Vic, and just letting you know in advance, he's just had a show at the Slate Gallery that was absolutely out of this world. So there are still a few pieces there for their Christmas show, so just letting them know in advance, just doing the commercial.
Thank you for that, Sandra. Today, we'll talk about green, a different kind of green. I'm not wearing a green t-shirt. Gardening has been a passion of mine, and I want to talk about what I consider the power of gardening. The idea of gardens, for those of you who read history, goes way, way back, thousands of years. We read about the gardens of Babylon 4,000 years ago that were considered by the Greeks to be one of the seven wonders of the world. The pre-Hispanic gardens in South America, the Aztec gardens, amazed their conquerors at the variety and the extent of the gardens throughout what became today Mexico. In fact, I was fortunate in 1965 to visit some of the gardens around the Chapultepec Palace, and it's absolutely amazing. Many people don't know food history and where food comes from. The foods we eat more than any others in the world, the potato, the tomato, corn. Corn has a history of 10,000 years being developed in Mexico. And of course, something that probably none of us can get along without, chocolate. There are many other plants that they grew and they shared with the rest of the world. And these plants originated in Mexico and Peru and other parts of South America. And often we think that, for example, in Europe, corn was always considered to be Turkish corn. I say that because my parents came from Romania, where mamaliga, or polenta, is one of the national dishes. And it's a national dish because the Ottomans, who controlled large parts of Romania back then, made a deal with the people who lived in that part of the world that they would pay their taxes in hard wheat, because Turks loved good bread. But the Romanians could grow all the corn they wanted. And so, of course, they did. Because corn came into Europe through Turkey, it was always called Turkish corn, and most people don't realize that these are plants that originated in Central America. The history of gardens in Canada actually goes back a couple of thousand years to the first Aboriginal people who broke soil and planted seeds and left us with a planting called the Three Sisters. These were three plants that they planted together in a mound: corn, beans, and squash. And these plants contribute to each other. If you've ever planted a small patch of corn in your backyard, maybe a dozen or two stalks, and we get a big wind, the wind will knock them over. Unless you do something to secure them. But if you grow them with pole beans and squash, they'll actually withstand the wind. So there was an idea behind it. But these plants also contribute to each other in terms of their growth potential. My own experience with gardens goes back to a toy shovel that my dad, who was a blacksmith, forged for me in his blacksmith shop at the corner of Abbott Street and Victoria Avenue. And this is, you know, many, many years ago. As you can see, the patina in my hair. And he forged the shovel so that I, along with the adults, could engage in the ritual of turning garden soil over. Each spring, my grandmother would go out and look for the first clods of green grass that were growing around her property. And she would dig up a couple of green clods, and she would place them on the front gate posts of her front gate, two clods of green grass. And then she would take pussy willows, three or four twigs or branches of pussy willows, and insert them in these clods of grass. And as a little kid, I wondered, you know, why does she do that? And when I'd ask her, you know, Grandma, why do you do this? And she would say, this is how we've always honored nature for the coming of spring and for another garden season. Another powerful image that stayed with me was of my grandmother in early spring going out to the garden and checking for signs that the garden was ready to be planted. And she'd bend down and pick up a handful of soil, and she'd smell it, and she'd squeeze it, and she'd rub it through her fingers and let it fall back to the earth. That also, as a kid, appeared to me strange, and I often wondered, you know, what does that mean? It was as if she was performing some kind of magic on the garden soil. So it was those kinds of experiences for me that actually had a profound effect on how I see the world and how I express myself. And I was lucky as an artist to find my my inspiration, or the inspiration for my art, in the backyard garden. And that's what I want to talk about today. I'm going to try to keep myself on track by checking out my major headings. I grew up in a place we called the Garlic Flats. This was a wedge of land in East Regina. It was a wedge of land that was bordered on the north by the CPR and on the south by the CNR, and it came to a point around McDonald Street. And I was imagined it as a teenager, as a wedge aimed at the heart of Regina. When I lived in that part of Regina, it was considered to be a third-class neighborhood. It was a neighborhood without sewer or water. The roads were, the road base would be cinders from the incinerator, the city incinerator. We had big gardens. We didn't have front lawns. And as a young teenager, I was saved from having to cut a lawn or anybody's lawn. But I became damn good at hilling potatoes and weeding. And for some reason, I became attracted to the garden, and it developed in me a passion and a love for gardening, which has stayed with me. And the early experiences of my grandmother and my parents, which was always somehow connected to the rhythms of nature, and a profound reverence and respect for the soil and for growing things and how you look after the soil. Now, the Garlic Flats was a place that was sparsely settled. And when I was a kid, the grassland, the prairie grassland, surrounded us. It had never been plowed. It was home to meadowlarks. It was home to horned larks, to burrowing owls, to frogs that you would hear late into the night along roadside ditches. And this diversity of life actually enlivened our neighborhood. Over time, a lot has changed in the Garlic Flats. The climate is no longer as predictable as it was back then. And the meadowlarks are in short supply. I don't know when you've last heard a meadowlark or a horned lark. I haven't for a long time. And I haven't been entertained for decades by frogs in a roadside pond. So much has changed. Unfortunately, a lot of these species seem to be going the way of the dodo bird. Now, if you look at history, there are plenty of examples of how humans have violated the natural processes of nature. Remember Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Sandy, Typhoon Haiyan just recently, and even more recently, a series of deadly tornadoes in the state of Illinois. I think these climate changes and these occurrences remind us that the climate is changing closer to home, and not much talked about in our media, is a culture that was practiced for thousands of years in ice-cold, predictable climates by the Inuit in the Canadian Arctic. And when you read about what's going on there, the place is melting. Shorelines are melting. The ice is melting. History is replete with examples of ecological disasters. The Maya of Mexico, that survived several thousand years of highly sophisticated culture, suddenly collapsed because they overshot the carrying capacity of their environment. They exhausted their resources, and abandon their cities suddenly to nature. And today they stand as silent warnings of human violations of the natural forces of the environment. When we disregard those natural forces, we expose ourselves to catastrophic climate dangers. Now, most of us live in cities. Cities are our greatest challenge, how we live in cities. But they're also, I think, our greatest hope. They offer a favorable setting for people to discuss and deal with resolving climate and environmental issues and social issues. We have to ask ourselves what kind of city we want to live in and what kind of world we want to leave for our grandchildren. And although the problems are often insurmountable, for example, on the prairies, water will become a great issue. Once the water towers that feed our water system, the Wascana Lake, for example, Buffalo Pound, Lake Diefenbaker, the water towers are the ice, the glaciers in the mountains. Once they're gone, there are going to be huge issues for us in terms of water usage. We waste water. We need to learn how to conserve it rather than misuse it as we do now. There are hopeful signs, though. I'm not discouraged. I'm discouraged about a lot of things that go on, as I'm sure many of you are. But there are hopeful signs that maybe, just maybe, we can turn things around. Human survival has always depended on adapting ourselves and our environment into healthy, sustaining ways, into meaningful and artful ways that help us understand our place in nature. And I think that's why the boom in backyard gardening is important. Community gardens, rooftop gardens, front yard gardens is a growing phenomenon. And they are a good way for people in a neighborhood to engage together in creating something beautiful and something useful. The most spectacular example of the urban garden resolution is what's happening in Cuba, in Havana, Cuba. When the Russians left and the Cubans were left with little oil and without petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides, they turned to small-scale urban gardening. In the last 15 years, the Cubans in Havana and throughout the country have developed one of the most successful examples of urban organic gardening. In Havana, there are over 8,000 community gardens that are run by around 30,000 people who daily practice the principles of organic gardening. The Cubans feed the Cubans in Havana feed themselves most of the vegetables that they eat, over 80%. There's also a worldwide consciousness, almost everywhere, of people who are interested in healthy food. Look at the development of farmers' markets. In 1965, when we were going, in 1960, actually 68, when we were attending the University of California, we visited our first organic farmers market. Back then, they were small. Today, the farmers market is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and the people who are producing food organically is growing. People are looking for locally grown food. Look at the success of the Regina Farmers Market. Look at the growth of community gardens in Regina. One that I've been particularly associated with is the Grow Regina Community Garden on Queen Street. It's a garden with a difference. It's been given a mandate from the city of Regina to enhance the social, economic, and and cultural well-being of the residents of the city. What this garden is doing is developing not only beautiful plots of locally grown vegetables, but they're also including artwork as part of the community garden. And that's where I come in, and I'm happy to be able to work with that group of people. What they wanted was a couple of sculptures at the entrance of the community garden. And so I created a couple of large, almost 10-foot high, laser-cut steel images of a man digging and a woman planting. And these stand at the entranceway of the community garden. They've also asked me to design a gazebo for the center of the garden, where gardeners and classrooms, because there are classrooms that actually take plots of land and learn how to grow vegetables by getting their hands dirty, which is the best way to learn. And I was happy to support that project, because I think our children, and I think we are the only species that no longer teaches, or many of us, no longer teach kids where and how to find food. Every other species does that. The birds, the squirrels. We give our kids a toonie and tell them to go to 7-Eleven for a big gulp or something. Fortunately, I think things are beginning to change. You know, during Victorian times, gardening was actually taught in school as part of science. Today, we're making that move back. California has done that in a big way. There's a new school in Regina where my grandson is attending grade 8, and it's a new school on the Douglas Park School on Douglas Avenue. And they've actually designed the school as a tool of how a building works, and they've designed the playground so that classrooms can actually have plots of the playground in which they grow plants and care for them and get their hands dirty. That's such a much better way of learning how things grow rather than just reading about it in a book or listening to a teacher talk about it and show pictures. The big challenges ahead of us is to try to exploit the possibilities of urbanization for the continued growth of community gardens and of backyard gardens. Landscape architect Anne Whitson Spearon maintains that the future of humanity depends on the backyard garden. And she writes, and I'll quote, "The only sustainable occupation now open to Homo sapiens is that of husbandry. What the world needs most is a species with a green thumb." What she's saying is that the presentation of the planet lies not so much in going green or solar or using wind, as necessary as these technologies are, but in the backyard garden. The backyard garden, I think, is the most radical thing that you can do today in terms of climate change. And in terms of your own sanity, if you look at all the things that are happening around the world regarding the climate. The backyard garden dilemma, according to Michael Pollan, parallels the global dilemma. When gardeners plant, they occupy a garden, they occupy a piece of land, they get their hands dirty, they get involved with that piece of land, and they know that the only way they're going to get what they need and what they want from the soil is by giving the soil what it needs. I think for too long, our impact on the environment has harmed the land. Wendell Berry I should remember that. It's a delicious plant, actually, producing fruit. Wendell Berry contends that the environmental crisis is a crisis of character. It's us. And we have to ask ourselves how we can turn that around as individuals and become responsible stewards of the land that nourishes us, physically and spiritually. For me, it's a bit like going back to watching my grandparents and parents who came from cultures that were garden-centered. They were closer to nature. They lived closer to the rhythms of nature because they knew that the soil and the garden would sustain them. Before 1947, when the first supermarket appeared in the United States, people ate. They were fed. And it was gardens that fed them. And I think this is what Ann Spirin is saying, what Wendell Berry is saying, and what Michael Pollan is saying. We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity, something that belongs to us. But when we see the land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use the land with love and respect. To garden is to be a steward of the land. Gardening is a natural activity. It's as natural as a bird building a nest. Again, Ann Whitson Spearin, we humans are part of the natural world. Your principles attest to this. Our bodies, our minds, and habits shaped by the physical, chemical, and biological processes that sustain the earth. We can't create life. Nature does that. But we can manage it. We need to become stewards of the land because we share it with many other creatures, plants and animals. And we're dependent on each other. Once we understand and are awed by the beauty of nature, by the beauty of the earth, by the power of the garden, we will honor the earth with respect and reverence. In researching his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, which I'm sure some of you have read, Michael Pollan visited an organic grazing operation, and he writes, "The sun feeds the grass. The grass feeds the animals. The animals feed us, and they feed the soil." He concludes that there is a free lunch in nature, and it's solar energy. Apply that observation to the backyard garden. The sun feeds the plants, the plants feed us, and we cultivate and feed the soil. So as a gardener, you can have your cake, your carrot cake, actually, and eat it. Now, one backyard garden isn't going to save the earth, isn't going to make much of a change, but millions of backyard gardens. And this takes a change in our thinking, how we see the world, how we understand the world, and how we understand our place there as conscious creatures, and our responsibility, our moral responsibility, to look after the environment we live in. So my message is to love the earth, love life, get your hands dirty, and may every creature abound in well-being and peace. Go green.
This one's for you.
Okay, I think we're ready here.
Yes. I think I'll just put this back here. Yes.
Oh, just wait. We'll give you this because it's important for everybody to hear.
My name is Becker. I can relate to that. My grandparents were homesteaders, and here on the prairie, and we think of this as cold Saskatchewan, there was no electricity, and everything was grown, and that's what you ate all year because it was canned, because you didn't have freezers and things like that. But I still liked having a Christmas orange once a year.
I agree. I had one this morning. Delicious. An organic orange that came from China, apparently. Mandarin.
in parts of Calgary, there's an area where they are getting people to have not only backyard gardens, but front yard gardens where they can use part of their front lawn. And they're encouraging us, everybody, to be organic. But can we truly be organic? Because we have a garden out of town as well. And there we water out of a dugout, which is runoff water where the farmers are fertilizing their and then the airplanes are going overhead and spraying. And then I say that my vegetables are organic. Are they truly organic?
Well, no. I think we've gone crazy with the use of chemicals in our environment, and all of us carry residual chemicals that were not in the bodies of people back when they were homesteaders. People always used methods to look after insect pests. I mean, when you're going organic, you're still making decisions about which plant you want and which plant you don't. Otherwise, so-called weeds would take over. Now, there are some weeds that that are excellent. I have a patch of nettles that grow in a corner of my garden, and I allow them to grow because it's one of the first greens I will pick with a glove on my hand. And steam lightly and butter or put some good olive oil on and a bit of salt and pepper, and it's the first green tonic that I can eat, including a lot of the early dandelions that volunteer themselves. So we make those kinds of decisions. So are we truly organic? I think organic food still tastes better compared to anything you buy in the supermarket. I think it's probably still less polluted. And the key, I think, is just to continue gardening and to compost and compost and compost. And you'll end up with vegetables that are healthy for you, for your kids, your grandkids, and also better for the land and for the planet.
My name's Julie. When I was a child, I certainly helped in my garden, my family garden. But I saw progress for myself as moving away from that. Being a professional, working in the community and making a living and making a place for myself there, not gardening and not looking after the land. Now, I've changed my opinion of what's important to me. And I'm just wondering what percentage of people are turning back to the soil, to wanting to create healthy food for themselves.
It's actually enormous. There's a revolution. For example, you're talking about a patch of land in Calgary where they're encouraging front yard gardens. In the United States, especially in the southern part, in Texas, of all states, which is usually considered to be one of the more right-wing states, one of the revolutions that's taking place is getting rid of your front lawn. And people are creating these incredible front yards that are edible, but also beautiful. They're beautifully sculpted and arranged, and they're not spending money on artificial fertilizers or pesticides. And I think that's a revolution. When I first bought one of the first houses I bought over in Old Lakeview, was one of those houses on a 25-foot lot. I was getting ready to go take my daughter to my mother's place for the morning, and I was strapping her on the bike seat, and a couple of neighbors were walking by, and they were standing there looking at my small lawn. I was never crazy about lawns, but the lawn happened to be there when I bought the house. And I says, "Is there a problem?" And they said, "Yeah, there's a problem. You've got some dandelions in your lawn." You know? And I said, I didn't put them there. I don't know where they came from, but they came from someplace. They may well have come from your place. But eventually I just dug them out. There are three or four of them. And I thought about it and began to read about dandelions and the money, the billions that are spent on chemicals to eradicate the dandelion. And I did a sculpture of a dandelion that became an addition, quite a successful one, and the title of it was The Persistence of Weeds. Shortly, we lived in that house, I think, for 3 years, and then we were moving out to the country, and I was telling my wife, Fran, I said, we're out in the country. People don't take lawns as seriously out in the country as they do in the city. I'm sure people aren't going to be too concerned about dandelions. Well, so we get this place. We bought the old Craven Schoolhouse, which we remodeled into a house and studio and a huge backyard, because we were part of that 60s group of people who decided that they'd like to move out to the country and become self-sufficient. And we were trying to figure out whether we could actually live off our backyard garden, which was actually quite large. And we had Last Mountain Creek behind us, so there was plenty of water. And so one day I'm out there working in the garden, and I could smell this weird chemical smell that I had smelled before, the smell of Killex. Now, when I asked, who's using Killex around here? So I go out to the easement between our properties, and my neighbors out there, there must have been five or six dandelions out there. And I says, Mel, what are you doing? And he says, I'm killing the dandelions. I said, look, leave the dandelions alone. Dig them up if you want to. But if you keep spraying them, next year there's six now. Next year there's going to be 12. And the year after that, there's going to be, 24 and 60. I says, it's something that it's a game that you'll never win. But he was quite concerned. He had a front yard. It was a new house. He had a front yard lawn and a backyard lawn, and he liked it cut just so, and he liked it fertilized, and he wanted it just pristine green, no dandelions. So it's changing. I think attitudes are beginning to change. A lot of these chemicals are considered to be, chemicals used for cosmetic purposes, and they're banned, or should be. It started in Hudson, Quebec. And I think in Regina, they're no longer using pesticides or herbicides on lawns. I live on Turnbull, and there's a big patch of dandelions every year. The city comes by and they cut them down. Years when I first bought the property, I was concerned about city people coming out there and spraying, and I wrote letters to the city complaining about the use of chemicals, and they said, 60% of the population still want them, so we still use them, but they're harmless. And I says, give me a break. So one night I get up to go to the bathroom, and I hear a commotion out in the boulevard. And there are three men out there in white suits and masks. And it's late at night, and there's a light breeze, and our windows are open, and they're spraying. So I got up, and I got on my computer, and I wrote another letter to the city. I said, what are you talking about, that these things are safe? I said, why are your people out there late at night with a gentle breeze blowing, dressed in white suits and wearing masks and spraying the boulevard? Well, I'm sure many other people have written letters to the city. Eventually, they stopped using pesticides. So it takes concerted effort by all of us to complain and to push the people who are in positions to make changes to make them and stick to them.
Okay, we're going to just have one last quick question here.
I don't know if it's a question, but I just wanted to say that I have been gardening, and my stepmother was the one who taught me. And I had a little six-year-old neighbor from a poor family who used to come, and she'd see me out there, and she'd come. And I taught her how to garden, and now she's a mother, and they live right across the street. And her daughter is gardening, and she's gardening in the front yard as well as the backyard. So I just found that very heartening. It's, you know, this, and she goes to Connaught School, so I think they're also doing some kind of gardening project there.
That's great. Like, we never had front yard lawns, as I said earlier. I mean, we grew cabbages and garlic and onions and lots of flowers, and then we had a backyard garden where, next to the summer kitchen, my mother would grow herbs and vegetables, and then we had a larger side garden. But the best thing you can do if you're gardening is to teach your grandchildren how to garden. I've got four, and they each have a little plot in my big backyard garden because I live in a crescent. They're responsible for planting, and I help them. They're responsible for weeding and initially watering, and then the automatic irrigation takes place. And they're also responsible for eating what they grow. And if they have to cook it, I'll show them how to cook beans or corn, and they love it. They come to the house, and they haven't got time to say, "Hi, Papa." They run out through the kitchen doors to see what's growing in their garden. Thank you.